I suppose I should start by commenting just a little bit on this title we've got here. I have to say, actually, I happen to be an admirer of the writings of Richard Dawkins. I'm sorry, in a way, to take his name in vain in this way. If you don't know who he's Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. And he's written some really wonderful books about evolutionary biology, which I've read over the years and which actually I think are rather good. So let me emphasize that I actually have no particular quarrel this evening. This Matt goes to sleep now again. Hope you don't, but there we go. That, you know, I don't really have any quarrel with this man, particularly about evolution. I'm not going to really talk about that tonight. So we're going to be talking about something a bit different. Our title derives, in fact, from Dawkins' recent book, The God Delusion. And I have to say, this is basically a sort of rant against religion, I think, let's be honest here. When you're reading this book, it's very, very different from Dawkins' other books, which are full of these sort of measured arguments, pithy illustrations to illustrate biology and so forth. But in this book, you have a very different style of writing. It's very much more polemical and so forth. And I actually find it quite interesting that the reviewers who've actually given Dawkins the hardest time on this particular book are his fellow atheists, fearing that Dawkins is letting the side down by writing such a poorly argued book in defense of atheism. Now, just as Christians cringe when they read extremist statements written by other Christians, so the atheist community cringes when one of its better-known advocates lets the side down so badly. And this is a quote from a friend of mine, Michael Ruse. "The God Delusion makes me embarrassed to be an atheist," said Michael Ruse. He felt quite upset, actually, about this book. And if you followed the reviews at all, you may have read this one by Terry Eagleton, who's not at all religiously committed. He's a Marxist professor of English literature at Manchester University. And opens his review of the London Review of Books with these immortal words: "Imagine someone holding forth on biology whose only knowledge of the subject is the Book of British Birds, and you have a rough idea of what it feels like to read Richard Dawkins on theology. Card-carrying rationalists like Dawkins, who is the nearest thing to a professional atheist we've had since Bertrand Russell, are in one sense the least well-equipped to understand what they castigate, since they don't believe there is anything there to be understood, or at least anything worth understanding. This is why they invariably come up with vulgar caricatures of religious faith that would make a first-year theology student wince." Well, that's actually one of the more positive parts of the review, actually. See, and then Lawrence Krauss also, in his recent review in Nature — this is the cartoon in Nature, that's not from me, it's entitled "Sermons and Straw Men," says that Richard Dawkins is a man on a mission. And so, perhaps not surprisingly, Dawkins' book has been sort of dubbed by some commentators as pointing to the rise of a kind of atheistic fundamentalism. Now, I think it's very tempting when you read a book which is rather sort of full of invective of this kind to reply in kind, and I don't think that's very helpful at all, and that's not what I want to do this evening. What I really want us to do is to have a useful and positive exchange of ideas. And I think in any case, quite a bit of the God delusion is rather tilting at windmills. And so, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of every detail of the book. What I want to do, though, is to pick on five general areas of misunderstanding that I think underlie some of Dawkins' approach to both science and religion. So we're going to work through five areas of what I think are misunderstandings. And the first of these areas refers to Dawkins' misunderstandings about how people actually acquire different beliefs. If you've read any of Dawkins' books, you'll be familiar with his idea of the meme. The meme. "People do not believe in God," says Dawkins, "because the intellectual case for such belief is compelling. They do so because their minds have been infested with a highly contagious and highly adapted God meme. They are the innocent, unsuspecting victims of a malignant virus of the mind." And Dawkins wrote about the meme, of course, long before he ever wrote about his most recent book. This is from The Selfish Gene. "Just as genes propagate themselves in the gene pool by leaping from body to body via sperm or eggs, so memes propagate themselves in the meme pool by leaping from brain to brain, by a process which, in the broad sense of the term, can then be called imitation." Now, I just want to suggest to you a few problems with the whole concept of memes. First point is that as a metaphor, it doesn't really serve any useful function in strictly scientific terms. Scientific discourse is actually full of vivid metaphors, and we can't do without them. We have
black holes and superstrings and sulfur genes and positive selection and hundreds of other metaphors. If we didn't have them, our laboratories would be very silent kind of places. But notice that these metaphors are thrown up spontaneously by the scientific community. They're not, as it were, enforced from outside. And in his book, Breaking the Spell, the philosopher Daniel Dennett has a complete appendix defending the idea of the meme. But I think if you have to defend a metaphor, that's a bad sign. Scientists will adopt new metaphors as they find them useful. Good metaphors require no defense. Now, in reality, I think most scientists think that the notion of a meme is pretty vacuous, actually. One reason is that there are plenty of words that do the same job as meme quite well already, and they're not particularly technical words, as you can see from the screen. They're words like custom, hummable tune, or this one I like particularly from the writings of Dan Dennett, wearing your baseball cap backwards. It's just not a meme that I've seen expanding very far in this country so far. So these words really do the kind of job that Dawkins is suggesting for the term meme. And so why suggest the term anyway? And I think probably the reason is because it sounds more scientific. It sounds like gene, but in reality we're just talking here about learnt customs and habits with a mode of transmission very different from that of genes. It's always seemed curious to me that a passionate Darwinian such as Dawkins should have promoted such a Lamarckian concept. I'll just leave that lying for the biologists here to think about. Now, we come across the same problem of metaphorical inadequacy with the idea of religion as a kind of virus, as a kind of viral infection. The way that viruses infect cells is very well understood. If you're thinking about the HIV virus, it needs to find entry into the cell, and it does that through a receptor, which is called CD4, which is on the surface of the cell. And here, if you want to have a look at it, it's not there, but just here is a beautiful picture from a recent issue of Nature showing this process in action. So we understand pretty well how HIV and other viruses get inside cells. But when you think about belief acquisition, how people acquire beliefs, it's really nothing like viral infection at all. You know, it's like comparing apples and oranges. I mean, the metaphor just doesn't really work. And so when we start comparing belief in God with being affected with a virus, you know, people don't believe in things in that kind of a way. As it happens, I have plenty of atheist friends who have become Christians in adult life. Their home environment was completely hostile to religion. They grew up, they started investigating faith for themselves, and intellectually they became convinced and they decided to become a Christian. And I also know some people who've made the reverse pilgrimage. They were brought up in religious homes and they decided later on to become atheists. But in none of those cases was the adoption of those beliefs anything like being infected with a virus. It wasn't even vaguely analogous. And so I'm afraid we have to conclude that Dawkins' enthusiasm for such metaphors stems from his need to use rhetorical devices to make his anti-religious points rather than actually using arguments themselves. For at the end of the day, and this is something I want to underline throughout this evening, at the end of the day, all belief systems have to be justified by rational argument. And one just further point about memes to mention. If they really infected brains like viruses, then we would have no valid beliefs left at all, including scientific beliefs. If a God meme is transmitted like a virus, then presumably an atheist meme can be transmitted equally effectively. It is even possible that believing in memes as a valid metaphor for the transmission of beliefs meme, if you follow that, could also be transmitted, if you see my point. If such automatic modes of thought transmission actually happened, then there is clearly no basis for the rational justification of any belief. The analogy, therefore, suffers from a kind of futility by infinite regress. Now, the second misunderstanding that Dawkins displays throughout his writings, actually, concerns the scope of science in relation to religious belief. And I think this is really, really important. Dawkins writes, "I pay religions the compliment of regarding them as scientific theories, and I see God as a competing explanation for facts about the universe and life." And then on page 50 of The God Delusion, we read, "Now I shall suggest that the existence of God is a scientific hypothesis like any other." So you see what's happening here. In this account, science and God are seen as offering rival accounts for the reality around us.
But this raises the obvious question as to what kind of explanations does science actually provide for us, and what counts as religious explanations? So, to answer that question, we have to think a little bit about science. Now, everybody knows what science is until they're asked to define it, and then things can get a bit fuzzy. So here's an attempt at a definition. Science is an organized endeavor to explain the properties of the physical world by means of empirically testable theories constructed by a research community trained in specialized techniques. It's not a perfect definition, but I think it does encompass many aspects of contemporary science. So we see what's going on here. The goal of the scientific community is to generate a body of reliable, constructed knowledge that is deliberately restricted in its ambitions to explaining the properties of the physical world. And so science achieves its clarity only at the price of looking away from layers of nature which is available to other kinds of experience. So how then should we relate scientific knowledge to other forms of human knowledge? And I would like to suggest that a helpful way is the way of what I've called an integrated complementarity. Imagine, for example, that the book of this complex entity called life is like a cube which is sliced into many layers, as shown here. And by life, I simply mean the sum total of all that we experience as human beings on this planet. So you need all the various levels of explanation to do justice to this complex entity that we call life. In reality, it's one book, we could say, but our brains are simply not up to the Herculean task of encompassing the understanding of that reality all at one go. And so we have different layers. We have a scientific level of understanding, which tells us how things work, where they came from, the mechanistic level, if you like. We have the ethical level, reflections about what we ought to do in the world, our ethical responsibilities and so forth. We have the aesthetic level, insights into beauty. We could have many other levels, of course, down here, the personal level, the way in which we construct our personal biographies in the world. And at the religious level, we're asking questions like, why is there a universe anyway? Or the question that Stephen Hawking likes to ask, which I like, what breathes fire into the equations, referring to equations that describe the properties of the universe? Does life have any purpose in any ultimate sense? How ought I to live my life? Does God exist? These are the big religious kind of questions, the ultimate questions. Now, what I want you to notice is that these various levels of explanation are in no sense rivals to each other. We need them all to do justice to our experience as human agents. For example, the scientific description of our brains in the kind of it language of science is complementary to the personal I language of human agency. And as far as the construction of our daily biographies is concerned, there's no doubt at all which of those accounts we actually value and claim to be most important. Most of the biographical narrative of our lives clearly lies well beyond science. No sane person, I hope, lives as if science is all you need. Science is not going to decide whether a painting or poetry or piece of literature or a sunset is beautiful or not, even though the broad parameters of what we count as beautiful may or may not be incorporated within the structure of our brains. So, in fact, effectively all the humanities lie beyond science, which is obviously why we have different departments and faculties in our universities. Now, such a model does not at all deny the complex interrelations indicated by these vertical arrows here between these different levels. They're really important. These levels are not isolated from each other, but the model is simply trying to point out the obvious, that no one explanatory level is sufficient by itself. Now, we might agree with all that's been said until now, but still have the strong feeling that scientific explanations are the only ones that provide us with reliable knowledge, whereas all other kinds of explanation for things belong to the realm of subjective opinion. At a mundane level, I think it's fairly easy to show that that feeling is actually quite false. In fact, every different discipline and area of life has its own valid ways of justifying its beliefs. Legal beliefs require legal justifications. Historical beliefs require historical justifications. Personal beliefs require personal justifications. If someone has been, let's say, happily married for 40 years with a partner who's shown consistent love and faithfulness over all those years, demonstrated by repeated acts of kindness, thousands of cups of tea,
then that person is well justified in their conviction that their partner loves them. Now, that's not science. But I don't think anything in a scientific journal that comes out this week will be better justified as a belief than that particular belief. It's a well-justified belief. It's definitely not within the realm of science. So there are many, many beliefs which can be very well justified, but which are not incorporated within the realm of science. And so the complementary model suggests a very different way of relating science and religion to that which Dawkins suggests. Far from being rivals, the vast majority of scientists would see the ultimate types of question that religion addresses as lying well beyond science. So, Martin Rees, president of the Royal Society, comments, "The preeminent mystery is why anything exists at all. What breathes life into the equation?" Same question we've had. "And actualize them in a real cosmos. Such questions lie beyond science. They are the province of philosophers and theologians." So the complementary model also helps us to see why Dawkins actually himself, and Christians as well, are equally hostile to arguments that depend on what's often called the God of the gaps idea of God's interactions in the world. And I think it's amazing how much time has been wasted both by religious people and by atheists, indeed, on the so-called God of the gaps argument, the suggestion that the actions of God are in some special sense indicated by pointing to these arenas, these holes, reflecting our current scientific ignorance. The big presupposition of Christian theism, for example, completely undermines such God of the gaps types of arguments. In Christian theism, God is the creator and sustainer of all that exists, or as Augustine put the point way back at the beginning of the 5th century, nature is what God does. And so in this view, our current scientific ignorance is actually irrelevant to the question of whether a creator God exists. For all our scientific descriptions are, by definition, descriptions in some sense of God's actions within that framework of understanding. Now, although science itself only gives us one narrow slice of reality, nevertheless, I do think that the scientific way of reasoning provides a very useful path to assessing metascientific or metaphysical questions, those questions that go well beyond science that Martin Rees talks about, the questions about which science is unable to adjudicate. Why does the universe go to all the bother of existing, to coin another nice phrase from Stephen Hawking? And I want to suggest that, in fact, there is no such animal as a metaphysically uncommitted human being. Every person has a metaphysical worldview, whether they know it or not, and whether they like it or not. And it's highly influential, actually, in ordering the direction of their lives. And I take scientific naturalism, or agnosticism, or atheism to represent metaphysical beliefs to which people are committed just as much as religious beliefs. In other words, nobody is standing on some lofty mountaintop devoid of metaphysical vegetation from which they can look down on the other benighted souls who are stuck with all those metascientific beliefs. We are all existentially committed to belief systems that go well beyond science, Dawkins as much as anyone else. Given that fact, why don't we adopt the metaphysical inference to the best explanation that seems to make best sense of the data? So, how do we do that? Now, my suggestion at this point is to include as data pretty much anything that strikes us as significant as conscious agents, as people in relationship with others who are determining their biographies on a daily basis. We can perhaps imagine the big rival metaphysical beliefs as these sort of big circles, as pictured here, that contain within them a lot of smaller circles that taken together comprise the richness of our lives. Music and art and ethical decisions and personal relationships, scientific knowledge, history, social studies, and on we could go, drawing lots and lots of other circles. In other words, my suggestion is that in contrast to science, where data are narrowly defined, when we come to comparing the big metaphysical systems, then we have to assess a much broader array of data. And so our question here is, what big circle makes best sense of the data? And I have to say that I find that kind of approach more useful than perhaps the more traditional philosophical arguments for the existence of God that Dawkins actually criticizes in his book. In reality, scientists, especially biologists like myself, we don't go around trying to prove things. Biologists never use the word proof, by the way. But we do start with models or hunches or hypotheses, and then we go around and we start looking for data and doing experiments that might count for or against that particular hypothesis. And in science, it's quite common in a research program to accumulate all kinds of isolated bits of data. In the beginning, you're really not quite sure what to do with them, and they don't seem to make any coherent story. You might not even believe them very much because they don't seem to fit together somehow. And you can be very skeptical sometimes about your data in the lab if it doesn't make sense. Once you have a coherent model that joins up the bits of data to generate a rational narrative, then you tend to believe your data with much less skepticism because the pieces of the jigsaw fit. They make sense. A very parallel process actually happens in theology. For example, when different parts of the biblical text, perhaps reflecting very different historical eras and literary styles, are connected up to make a coherent story. Or perhaps when different religious experiences join up to make a coherent story. As in science, so in faith. And in fact, scientific and religious ways of thinking have far more in common than most people realize, and I think that's explained to a very large degree by their common historical roots. For science was born in a theological womb. For example, both quests share this search for coherence within their different domains. Actually, as an evolutionary biologist, I think it's fascinating the way that Darwinian theory continues to give coherence to new biological data as it comes along, including the vast new array of data which has now been provided over the past 5 or 10 years by genomics, by DNA sequencing. So this is actually where I find myself, in this case, singing from the same song sheet, actually, as Richard Dawkins, when he writes in the preface to his book, The Blind Watchmaker, that one of my tasks, writing about his book, will be to destroy this eagerly believed myth that Darwinism is a theory of chance. Taken as a whole, evolution is very far from being a chance process. In reality, it's a tightly regulated process that has, to some degree, predictable outcomes. It is indeed, I would suggest, a historical narrative consistent with the existence of a God who has intentions and purposes for the universe that he's brought into being. So, we get enormous amounts of genetic variation generated in the genome, which gives us novelty, it gives us diversity, but at the same time, that's very heavily restrained by necessity to a relatively limited number of living entities. The thought is, if you live in a universe with these kind of physics and this kind of chemistry, on a planet with these particular properties, then as you look around the world, this is the biological diversity that you're likely to get. And so what we've done here in this rather simple model is to imagine every possible genome, every possible complete piece of genetic information, gene sequence that defines a particular organism. We've pictured those as little red boxes, millions and millions of little red boxes. And you'll notice that the number of genomes that will generate an organism that can function in some ecological niche somewhere in the world, these green boxes are pretty small. Necessity constrains those genomes in a very, very rigorous kind of way. The point I'm making here is that biological diversity is definitely not a question of anything goes. It's a highly organized process. And I thought I'd just stick in a couple of slides in case we have biologists here, and if this goes straight over your head, doesn't matter at all, don't worry about it. But if you're interested in the more technical aspects of this type of thing, then you might be interested in this particular article. It was published in Nature a couple of weeks ago, and it's about fitness landscapes in the technical language of the trade, this time applied to enzyme structure and function. But notice what the authors conclude in their paper down here at the bottom in the abstract, that only a few paths are favored also implies that evolution might be more reproducible than is commonly perceived, or even be predictable. There's a lot of recent scientific evidence in the literature that supports that kind of conclusion. I'll just give you one more example I had to because it's in the current issue of Nature, so it's nice and up to date. But this time it's comparing various fitness landscape models during the adaptive histories of individual organisms. As it happens, that's the model on the right that fits the data best. Well, you can tell that, can't you, just by looking at it. But also, this paper illustrates very well the way in which you can come up with nice competing models and do fancy math, but at the end of the day, you have to test it out on the data that you have, and that's exactly what that paper's about. Anyway, just flag that up for those who may be more technically, biologically interested. But I would say that when you look at those kind of constraints, highly organized processes, arguably an upper level narrative in which a personal creator God brings about a universe with these highly organized properties, including its evolutionary properties, culminating in the emergence of conscious personal life that's able to understand and appreciate the universe, that provides a better explanation than simply saying the universe is a brute fact and we actually don't know why. Now, before we pursue some of Dawkins' more theological concerns, let me just reflect on the third of Dawkins' misunderstandings, which is a misunderstanding, I think, about human nature. Dawkins is famous for seeing religion as, quote, the root of all evil, the title of his Channel 4 TV series last year, in case you saw that. Faith, says Dawkins, in a masterful piece of hyperbole, is a kind of mental illness, one of the world's great evils, comparable to smallpox virus, but harder to eradicate. So, not a man to mince his words. So as Dawkins fulminates against religion, it's, I think, actually ironic to reflect that the three defining parameters of his own academic life all have theological roots, and in fact some specifically Christian roots. First, Oxford University, where I happened to have done my own undergraduate degree, began to flourish from the 12th century onwards, and its whole structure and ethos for centuries was deeply influenced by Christian faith. The university's motto, shown here, is taken from the opening words of Psalm 27, Dominus in laminatio mea, the Lord is my light. Not a bad place to start. Second, Dawkins College, New College, was founded for specifically Christian reasons in the late 14th century. And third, Dawkins' discipline, zoology, has its roots deep in Aristotelian science in the first place, and then in the Christian worldview of 16th and 17th century Europe, as natural history began to emerge as a distinct discipline. And so Dawkins owes much to his university, much to Christianity, for his university and his college and his science. And I think it's therefore difficult to take seriously his claim that religion is the root of all evil. That certainly hasn't been the case for the shaping of his own biography. But more broadly, I want to flag up a few further points on this topic. First of all, there's no such thing as religion, as if it was some monolithic entity. However, there are thousands and thousands of different religious beliefs. We're talking here about something quite complex. And I think what's frustrated academic commentators, people like Michael Ruse, is the way in which Dawkins has adopted such an extreme position on a question which is actually quite complex. There are certainly plenty of religious beliefs that I would not like to defend. I am, like Dawkins, an atheist in response to much religious belief. The problem with the term atheist is that it expresses disbelief in something. It's a negative philosophy rather than the kind of positive explanations that we're used to in scientific discourse. In fact, Christians in the second century were accused of being atheists because they didn't worship the Roman emperor. Jesus himself was very anti-religious, you could say. He reserved his most stringent critiques for religious leaders who practiced the outward trappings of their religion without paying attention to love and mercy, justice, things like that. Secondly, Western commentators writing within societies in which religious belief is a matter of personal choice can easily forget that this luxury is not the case for most countries of the world. Most people, as in Turkey and Lebanon, where I actually spent 15 years of my life, have their religion written in their identity card. It is indeed their cultural identity and has nothing to do with whether they practice their country's religion or not. I have plenty of atheist Turkish friends who nonetheless have Muslim written in their identity card as their religion. For the vast majority of the world's population, religion and culture are completely intertwined. So trying to come to simplistic conclusions about actual religious belief and practice in such contexts is really impossible. I lived for 5 years through a significant slice of the Lebanese Civil War during the early 1980s, including the 1982 Israeli invasion. But if you think that particular conflict was about religious beliefs, I'm sorry, but you're quite mistaken. And that brings me to my third point about religion as the root of all evil. Dawkins spends pages of The God Delusion trying to persuade us that whilst religious people do evil things out of religious motivations, this, of course, is not the case with atheists like Stalin, whose atheism is coincidental to their acts of evil. Critics, I think, rightly condemned Dawkins for being disingenuous in this context. Only someone in a very isolated ivory tower with very little knowledge of history of the real world could have written such statements. For the fact of the matter is that the suppression of religious belief is intrinsic to the atheism of Marxist-Leninism, and every single Marxist regime without exception has practiced such suppression, including the infringement of human rights, which continues in countries such as China and North Korea right up to the present day. Chairman Mao was responsible for the deaths of up to 70 million people during his atheistic regime, Stalin for at least 20 million. As Alan Orr comments in his recent review of Dawkins in the influential New York Review of Books, it is hard, and I quote, it is hard to believe that Stalin's wholesale torture and murder of priests and nuns, including crucifixions, and Mao's persecution of Catholics and extermination of nearly every remnant of Buddhism were unconnected to their atheism. In February 2004, the BBC broadcast a program entitled What the World Thinks of God. As part of their research, they commissioned Bradford University's Peace Studies Department to carry out an audit of wars over the last century with specific reference to the role of religion in causing those wars. The researchers then analyzed the 32 wars of the 20th century, and they found that only three had a significant religious element, actually involved in killing about 1% of all those killed in secular wars over the same period. But fourthly, nobody at all denies that evils have been committed and continue to be committed in the name of religion. With more than 80% of the world's population continuing to describe themselves as belonging to a religion, it would indeed be remarkable if this were not the case. But equally, science has been used for great evils. The mass killing that took place in the 34 wars of the 20th century was hugely facilitated by scientific advances, not least by E equals MC squared. But personally, I don't give up on science simply because great evils have been committed in its name. Neither do people give up on sex because of the existence of rape. So I think the moral is we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And fifthly, as it happens, in any case, once you start measuring the actual effects of religious belief scientifically, then it turns out it's rather good for you. I did my early research on the brain at the Institute of Psychiatry, just down the road here, and that was an era when many secular people still believed that religion was some kind of obsessional neurosis that was bad for your mental health. Hardly anybody believes that anymore, for the simple reason that the empirical data are overwhelmingly against the idea. Just to give you one example, a few years ago a book was published by OUP, Oxford University Press, summarizing and assessing the results of 100 evidence-based studies that systematically examined the relationship between religion and human well-being, and here are the results. 79 of these studies reported at least one positive correlation between religious involvement and well-being, 13 found no meaningful association, 7 found mixed or complex associations, and there was one that found a negative association between religion and well-being. Now, notice here that Dawkins' entire worldview depends on a supposed negative association between religion and human well-being, whereas in reality, only 1% of the experimental results actually support his claim, and 79% quite clearly reject his suggestion. So I think the results make one thing at least abundantly clear. We need to approach the subject in the light of the scientific evidence and not personal prejudice. So taking Dawkins' third major understanding, sort of misunderstanding overall, I think it turns out that actually evil is simply part of the human dilemma, and the particular directions in which evil is expressed have many and varied and complex motivations. We all, religious, agnostic or atheist, are in the same boat together. I actually wrote that forgetting that we were going to be in a boat tonight, actually. But, so there's no intended pun there, but we are. Okay, at the end of the day, no one can really point the finger at anyone else. As Jesus said, let him who is without sin cast the first stone. And so the actual data, as we look out on the world, point to a profoundly Christian conclusion, as it happens, that the alienation from God, which Christians call sin, and which is the source of evil, is a deeply troubling characteristic of all human existence. The fourth main misunderstanding I wish to briefly address is that of Dawkins' misunderstandings about the Bible and theology. It is ironic, I don't know if you read The God Delusion, but at the end, Dawkins encourages Bible reading as being good for our culture, because we should understand the Bible as literature. But the point about great literature is that it's there to be understood. And I have to warn you that Dawkins is a poor guide to understanding the Bible. And I don't have time to fully justify that statement. I just want to give you a few examples. For example, Paul is not the author of the letter to Hebrews, as Dawkins states in his book. I think we've known that for a few centuries. Christians do not believe that they are bound by the details of the Old Testament law, as Dawkins seems to think. If you read the Sermon on the Mount, then you'll see what I mean. On a slightly more technical point, but on page 94 of his book, Dawkins says that Luke's Gospel has it wrong on the events of Jesus' birth being linked to a census. But this has been very well looked at by historians, and there is good evidence that the census, which is described in Luke chapter 2 and verses 1 to 5, refers to a census not for taxation purposes, the word taxation is not in the original Greek, but for allegiance to Caesar Augustus, as recorded by the historian Orosius. Now, we don't have time for that, but if you want a journal paper on that particular subject, very happy to send you the PDF if you ask me afterwards. So I think Dawkins is simply wrong in his claim of Luke's inaccuracy. And then another place, Dawkins claims that the death of Jesus refers to atonement for Adam's sin, whereas I don't think any Christian is in any doubt that Christ died for the sins of the whole world, including our own. I could go on, but I think the point is made. If you want to understand the Bible, then you need to read it carefully, preferably with a good commentary, to provide the sort of necessary accurate historical background and cultural context. One would hope, and this is the embarrassing part, one would hope that the scientist would at least get their facts right, but I'm sorry to report that is not the case for the author of The God Delusion. Now, the fifth and final misunderstanding I'd like us to consider this evening is Dawkins' misunderstanding about the nature of faith. Faith, Dawkins confidently asserts, is blind trust in the teeth of the evidence. But of course, no serious theologian has ever suggested that this is what Christian faith involves. It is a self-serving parody which has no relationship to reality. Christian faith is, in fact, evidence-based faith. Faith in itself is not a virtue or an end in itself. It is God, the object of our faith, who is important. And the Christian God is not the powerful but complex superhuman conjured up by Dawkins' fertile imagination, in whom he doesn't believe, and neither do I, but rather a God who is totally other than human, completely distinct from the creation he has brought into being and continues to sustain. So it's simply not meaningful to talk about God as being complex, as if he were a physical object with lots of components, as Dawkins does. God is not a physical object at all. God as creator means God as the source of all other existence. So God cannot be constrained in any way by the universe. Now, all of our language is obviously inadequate and by necessity anthropomorphic as we attempt to describe God, but the simplicity of his essence is something perhaps more analogous to that pure essence of the early femtoseconds of the universe after the Big Bang, before our present physical laws emerge from that profound primal simplicity. Or perhaps more analogous to pure mind, which sees everything in its entirety without need for the human constraint of complexity. And I want to suggest just two main approaches in this pathway to evidence-based faith. The first we've touched on already, a serious comparison of the big competing metaphysical models as explanations for the existence of the universe. In practice, we all have to live our lives as if we already knew the answer to Leibniz's great question he posed back in the early 18th century, why is there something rather than nothing? On one side, we have atheism with its claim that the universe is simply a brute fact without need of any further explanation, which is a research stopper, actually, something we don't like in science. Or on the other side, we have a more, I would say, open-minded quest, which suggests that there might be an ultimate explanation for the existence of the universe and of conscious observers within it. Now, which metaphysical claim makes the best sense of the universe? Which is the most coherent? For sure, we're never going to get complete coherence in this life, but we can certainly ask the question, which model is more coherent? That's something that we can do. And then the second approach to faith focuses down on particular religious claims. In this case, the historical claims for the life, divinity, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Those who've done even a little philosophy of science will be familiar with the name of the great 20th century philosopher Karl Popper. And Popper famously made refutation or falsifiability as a key demarcation that separates science from non-science. And I think it's intriguing to find that the Apostle Paul in the New Testament had precisely this kind of Popperian attitude towards the evidence for his faith. Writing indeed to the church in Corinth, in Greece, that if the resurrection hadn't happened, then Christian faith was futile. It was a waste of time. If the dead are not raised, wrote Paul, let us eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. He was a true Popperian well before his time. Now, of course, we're not in the same position as Paul. We don't have direct access to the data, but we can at least identify with the empirical reasoning process of the first century community of faith. And so faith in Christ is not some airy-fairy wish fulfillment, but evidence-based faith rooted in the historicity of Jesus of Nazareth. And I think it seems odd that in The God Delusion, Dawkins spends pages picking at tiny points in the birth accounts of Jesus in the Gospels, but he virtually ignores the resurrection of Christ, which is actually really is central to Christian faith. Why is that? So, what I've tried to do this evening is not to try and cover all the 406 pages of Dawkins' God Delusion in 45 minutes, but I've tried to highlight five of the significant general misunderstandings, as I see it, in his arguments about belief acquisition, about the scope of science, about human nature, about the Bible, and about faith. Four, at the end of the day, all beliefs have to be justified by the evidence and by rational argument. And for myself, as a scientist, I have to say I'm persuaded that my faith in God through the living Christ is a belief that is indeed well justified by the evidence. So, thank you for your attention.